On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Flanagan, Mr. Brian Chi, and Mr. Oliver Riss on the show. Full panel. You may have heard about Industry 4.0, which is the digital transformation of the manufacturing industry. However, the question is, are they going too fast? Maybe not securing things well enough. We'll definitely talk about it. Plus, we have a full panel to talk about the important topic about organizational security, and we're going to go deep in MFA, multi-factor authentication. You might just be surprised how easy it is to actually move to it. You have lots to talk about there. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Twiet on the set.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twiet.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 495, recorded May 27th, 2022. MFA is the way. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by FlexTrack, the proactive security management platform. Save time and increase productivity with the premier cybersecurity reporting and workflow management product designed to support the complete security lifecycle from assessment through remediation. Visit FlexTrack.com/twit. to claim your free month. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And by Nareva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation can take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex, expensive. But Nareva Audio is easy to install and manage, and no technicians required, and you get true full room coverage that's easy, economical. Learn more at Nareva.com. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm Louis Maresca, your host and your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts. And today we have a full panel of experts. That's right, starting with their very own contributing editor at PC Mag. He's Mr. Oliver Risk. Oliver, great to have you back, my friend. I've been cranking up the smoker lately.
I have pork shoulder. Pulled pork is one of my wife's favorites. So working on the Cuban version of that. But it came out pretty good. I want to try it again, but it came out pretty nice.
I love Cuban sandwiches. Now you go all out with the pickled relish and all that stuff.
No, she doesn't like that. I got some nice barbecue sauce going, then I had to follow another recipe for better sauce. It was kind of involved.
Very nice. Well, hopefully it'll be a good long weekend for you. Thank you for being back. Well, speaking of experts, we also have our own very own senior analyst at Omdia. He's our security and enterprise expert, and he's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend? How was your week?
Well, as a resident of Florida, I have to tell you that if you put relish on a Cuban sandwich, you're a monster. And this is just a terrible thing. The Cuban sandwich is a very defined thing, which, by the way, must be on Cuban bread, and you have to make it the way it was made in its home and origin, Ybor City, Tampa, not in those newfangled folks down in Miami and whatever they claim to make. Tampa is where it's from, and I'll fight you if you disagree. Anyway, now that that's out of the way, it's been a pretty good week. Managed to get one of my big research projects published this week, have my big data asset, including market projections in cybersecurity awareness training through 2026. That's up on omdia.com. And I am hip deep in getting ready for the RSA conference, which comes up in just a couple of weeks. Getting ready to head out there. I'll be meeting lots of people, doing some LinkedIn Live, I hope, and I should be back in my office in time for Twiet that week, so can bring lots of news and goodness from RSA. And then the week following, I'm out in Las Vegas at the Splunk conference, and again, that should have some good news and information coming out of it. So lots of stuff to get ready for, and is I feel that's not exciting enough. I am getting ready for Black Cat and DEF CON. I actually got my badge purchase for DEF CON today. So moving ahead with all of the in-person events to come.
Exciting. I'm actually looking forward to hearing what comes out of these conferences this year. So hopefully we'll get a little bit of taste when you're out there. So great to see you again, Curtis. Thanks for being here. Well, speaking of experts, also we have the geek from Paradise and Sunshine. That's right. He is a all-around tech geek and network expert, and he is Mr. Brian Chee. Mr. Brian Chee, welcome back, my friend. How has your week been?
I'm still on the recovery. It was 4 days of MegaCon. And interesting enough, apparently people were really, really interested in coming back to an in-person conference because it set records at 130,000 plus attendees. Wow. And so the makerspace had a room kind of off to the side, which is nice because we could hear ourselves think. And lots and lots of people wanted to learn how to solder, and one of our members did a ginormous cosplay. It's one of the guardians from Legends of Zelda. And so it had blinky lights and all kinds of stuff, and they actually had some Zelda cosplayers propose marriage right in front of the guardian. It was super cool.
That's really interesting. They actually got married in front of it, or they just proposed?
No, they just proposed.
Okay. Fantastic. Yeah, that was a really cool... Now, that was all built from custom, from the ground up?
Yeah, actually, it's spray foam, PVC pipes, paper mache, moss, all kinds of stuff. But she'll be posting it to Instructables eventually. And she has a whole bunch of time-lapse on how it was built. And it was... the lights were controlled with a Teensy and a little tiny keyboard that they could use to hit different audio and video, audio and LED sequences.
Very cool. Cool stuff. Well, we know the interesting thing here is like the Maker Faire, you're always going to get surprised, or at least Maker Boots even. You're always going to get surprised what people think, what people have time to build. It's pretty amazing. So hopefully, now, is there any Maker Faires coming up for you guys? I know you just had one recently, right?
No. Maker Faire Orlando is first weekend in November.
Okay.
And I'm hurriedly taking apart some old mobility scooters to scrap them and try and build a platform to put an electric cupcake together. So I'll be, if all goes well, I'm going to be driving around Maker Faire in an electric cupcake, and there'll be a little green wagon attached to it so we can move things around the fair in style.
In style, indeed. Well, thank you, Chee, for being here. Thank you guys for all of you being here. We definitely have a really busy week in the enterprise. We definitely should get started here. Now, you may have heard about the term Industry 4.0, which is the digital transformation of the manufacturing industry. However, the question is, are they focusing enough on security? We'll talk about it. We'll see if they are or not. Plus, we have a full panel today. We're going to talk about a very important topic in when organizations implement security. That's right. We're going to go deep into MFA. And you might just be surprised just how easy it is for you and your organization to move over to it. So we'll definitely get to get into that and get deep into that topic. So definitely stick around. We have lots of fun stuff to talk about here. But first, there's been lots going on in the enterprise this week. So let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, acquisitions this year have been kind of slow. Lots of announcements, but not a lot of movement with them. Now, we heard about Microsoft trying to acquire Activision for $68.7 billion. We've also heard about the controversial deal from Elon Musk to try to buy Twitter for $48.4 billion. In the beginning of the year, there was also an announcement of Akamai acquiring Linode, who's also a sponsor, for $900 million. However, there haven't been too many that have been disrupting the world of IT enterprise. Until now, this past week, Broadcom has announced that they are acquiring VMware for $61 billion. Now, the deal is expected to close in Broadcom's fiscal year 2023, which actually starts in November. Now, in the past, VMware has been part of a larger acquisition deal when Dell bought EMC for $67 billion in 2016. Now, VMware spun off from Dell last year. However, Michael Dell still maintained a 40% stake in the company. That's a big chunk. Now, he might be able to actually overtake Mr. Musk and Bezos with this deal. Now, you might be asking, why is Broadcom Broadcom buying VMware? Well, Broadcom already has a software department focused on infrastructure and security solutions, but sees VMware's products as complementing that actual lineup. Now, in fact, the deal is when the deal is actually complete, the Broadcom software group is set to be rebranded as VMware. Now, this brings a semiconductor company together with an enterprise software company with a proven track record. That means hardware and software under one umbrella. You might know some other companies that have that model as well, but with this new combination, they can now offer complete solutions and support under one roof. That, my friends, is a recipe for success.
Okay, we know your first pet meant the world to you, and your high school mascot, Go Binturongs, bring back fond memories, but you can't keep using the same password for every online account. Why? Well, this week, General Motors and wedding planner startup Zola revealed attacks that exposed customer personal information and, in the latter case, hit customers with loss of stored funds and fraudulent payment card charges. In both cases, credential stuffing was the threat actor's tactic of choice. Now, in credential stuffing, attackers use automated scripts to try high volumes of stolen username password combination against online accounts in an effort to take them over, a tactic that frequently uses vast files of stolen credentials to see who has been using the same credentials over and over again. Now, once they have a hit, criminals can use the compromised accounts for a variety of different purposes, including pivoting to penetrate deeper into a victim's machine and network, draining accounts of sensitive information or monetary value, and, if it's an email account, impersonating the victim in business email compromise attacks on others and just extending the chain of misery. These credential stuffing accounts are expensive and all too common. Firm Perimeter X says that malicious login attempts out of total logins trended upward during 2021, reaching a staggering 93.8% of all login attempts in August. Why so high? It's simple. The credential stuffing technique hits an account over and over and over again, trying to find it. Legitimate attempts only hit it once. When successful, businesses lose an average of $6 million per year to credential stuffing in the form of application downtime, lost customers, and increased IT costs. The worst part is that the information stolen from GM and Zola will almost certainly be seen again, used in yet another round of credential stuffing attacks against yet another group of unfortunate companies.
Hey, have I got a deal for you? There's a Nigerian prince that needs your help dealing with some lost money. Well, Interpol did something about it. Interpol this last Wednesday announced that Operation Delilah has resulted in Nigerian police arresting the suspected head of Silverteria, a.k.a. TMT, which is a massive BEC operation that has been active since at least 2015, impacting thousands of businesses and individuals across four continents. The 37-year-old Nigerian man, who Interpol did not name, was apprehended at the Murtala Mohammed International Airport in Lagos as he attempted to re-enter the country after fleeing ahead of the police in 2021. I don't know about you folks, but those Nigerian prince emails, while annoying, were also pretty entertaining and gave me a giggle all the way up to hitting the delete key. What does this mean? Is that international law enforcement are quite serious about internet fraud, and maybe we really can have nice things in the future. I, for one, would love to be able to safely order hard-to-get offshore trinkets without having to worry about lining the pockets of a fraudster.
A recent paper from Chinese researchers outlines the potential military threat that SpaceX's satellites and their internet system pose to China, and how the country should respond. One wild guess as to how they think they should respond. So a group of Chinese researchers is urging China to come up with ways to disrupt and destroy SpaceX's satellite internet service, Starlink. Last month, China's Modern Defense Technology Journal published a paper which lays out why Starlink poses a serious threat to the country. The South China Morning Post, which was first to report about it, also notes that the research paper comes from five researchers who are affiliated with China's defense industry. The paper says, while Starlink is booming, and also because of its huge comprehensive application potential, it has brought hidden dangers and challenges to our country. Starlink already spans over 2,000 orbiting satellites, but SpaceX is working to one day expand the network to over 30,000 satellites in an effort to supply high-speed broadband to consumers and businesses around the globe. However, the Chinese researchers are worried that Starlink could also be used for a wide range of military applications, including having the U.S. beam internet comms to its troops and to aircraft in the field. Then again, one of the people who I believe is least capable of carrying out any kind of secret mission would be Elon Musk. He has to be at the top of that list. The Pentagon may pay $600 for a toilet seat, but no way would they trust Elon Musk with anything secret. Plus, no offense to China, but you have to wonder if they're really afraid of military comms or whether maybe they just don't want a set of free internet satellites floating above their population.
Encrypted email has been something many people are moving to in order to modernize the security of a legacy technology. Now, Proton Mail has been at the center of this movement for at least the last 8 years. However, why stop there, right? The company is looking to expand its offerings to help them penetrate other parts of the market. In fact, this past week, they've decided to rebrand themselves Proton instead of Proton Mail in hopes of taking some more steps into privacy and other parts of the market. The company will now offer an ecosystem. That's right, an ecosystem of linked products, all accessed via one paid subscription. Now, Proton subscribers will have access to not just the encrypted email service, but also an encrypted calendar, file storage platform, and VPN. Now, that means that Proton might just be targeting Google a bit with this movement. Now, at least Proton Mail updates their email client every once in a while, unlike some other email clients that are out there. Now, why would you want to use their service? Why would you want to be tracked? Why would you want to be not tracked, right? Why would you want end-to-end encryption? Well, that's exactly what Proton Mail and Proton Services will give you. You get Proton Calendar, Proton Drive, and Proton VPN in just one subscription that gives you access to all those services. And I, for one, am rooting for them because competition is really good for the soul. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's FlexTrack, the premier cybersecurity reporting and workflow management platform that empowers teams to win the right security battles. And what if you could streamline the communication across the entire security department so that every team member could do their job more efficiently? From simplified data aggregation and reporting to integrated ticketing for remediation to analytics and visualizations for board reporting, FlexTrack touches every aspect of the security management workflow. Gain a real-time view of your security posture by bringing all of your data sources together into one powerful platform where you can triage scanner results, generate powerful analytics and visualizations, assign remediation tasks, attest to your posture, and you can track your progress over time. As a satisfied FlexTrack client put it, we see FlexTrack as a part of our strategy to move quicker and be proactive. Now we have a real-time view of what we need to focus on, and I have an easy way of showing senior leadership. FlexTrack serves every aspect of the Enterprise Security Team program, which with features designed to improve workflow, collaboration, and communication for each role, including they have red team aggregation. That's right. Import data from all of your automated vulnerability scanners and tools, triage and report results in half the time. They also have blue team remediation. You can assign remediation tasks right on the platform or through a simple integration with the ticketing tools your team already uses, and you can track progress over time. In fact, you have stakeholder communication capabilities as well. Use powerful yet simple analytics to attest to security posture and prioritize issues. You can tailor attestation and communication to the needs of both team members and the C-suite. Plus, you have continuous purple teaming assessment. Begin purple teaming or power up your current strategies with Runbooks, the best in industry tool for test plan execution. Security teams of all sizes and maturities can maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of their workflows with FlexTrack. Customers report that they see FlexTrack as a part of our strategy to move quicker and be proactive. that the platform has a 5x return on investment in year one, and that it gives their cybersecurity operations a 30% increase in efficiency. PlexTrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track the issue to completion straight from the platform. Book a demo today. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's PlexTrack.com/TWIT. And we thank PlexTrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, Industry 4.0 is here, and the manufacturing industry is moving quickly to digitally transform themselves. The question is, are they moving too quickly to think about security? Curtis, what's going on there?
Well, once upon a time, you would actually hear engineers in manufacturing say that there wasn't any need to put cybersecurity on their industrial controllers, the ICS products, because no one would want to harm them. I mean, what would be the point? They can't get money off of them. They can't get customer data or anything like that. Why would they waste their time? Well, we now know that that's false. We've seen cases of things like ransomware used on industrial controllers. We've seen companies be attacked. We've seen nations and nation states be attacked through the industrial control systems. Now the question becomes even more a case of whether those industrial control systems, or OT, operational technology as it's often called in the industry, might be a stepping stone to IT. In other words, when systems are so closely linked, could someone get from one to another? Well, the answer is possibly yes, and therefore many more people are paying attention to the cybersecurity of operational technology. It's reached a point where people are talking about manufacturing software maturity. Now, if you've never dealt with enterprise software, the software maturity model might be something that you're not familiar with. It is something that was initially developed to be part of resilience and software quality so that the software stayed available and the systems that they ran on stayed available. Now it's considered not only availability, but cybersecurity. It's that whole CIA triad, you know, availability, integrity, and whatever the C stands for. I'm having a senior moment and it just left my head. Confidentiality. Confidentiality, integrity, availability. Maturity hits all of those. And maturity is starting to be used in operational technology. Now, what about Industry 4.0? Industry 4.0 is a set of standards and best practices that will help those who adopt it have better quality, more reliability, more availability, and greater cybersecurity. The question is, will manufacturers do this when, as we know, anything involving cybersecurity does involve cost? The question for many companies is going to be whether that cost is justified by the change in their risk posture. It is a wonderful question. And, you know, I want to start with a question to Lou. Lou, from where you sit, is software maturity something that, A, you're aware of, and be something that you are aware of people in your sector of the industry making use of?
Yeah, I think that obviously software maturity, like they, it depends on how applications were originally built. I think that they were originally, some of them were built to be cloud native applications. They are thought to have, to be, you know, more mature, I guess you could say, than the ones that were built for, you know, for more on-premise or ones that needed to be moved to the cloud. And I think that is a case where, you know, a lot of organizations are starting to take a real serious look at whether they could go to more native versions of the applications, because they're thinking, they know that these things will be integrated better and have a better understanding of what it means to secure things and be, you know, and being compliant and be and so on and so forth. So I think it's a big topic for a lot of organizations. A lot of them have to consider that when they're moving things.
You know, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that has to be considered in the entire maturity model is the fact that there are still so very many devices used as industrial controllers that were never intended to be updated, that were never intended to have the kind of security that we now take for granted on IT systems. Brian, how is that OT controller space doing? Are companies now accepting that they have to make these devices manageable and upgradable, or are we still looking at putting thousands upon thousands of devices into the field that are sitting ducks for threat actors?
I think the biggest problem is the historical background on programmable logic controls, PLCs. The original ones that I got to first exposed to, you actually downloaded microcode into them so that you didn't have to worry about delays in the communication. Because back in those days, the communication was serial. The best you had was, say, something like RS-485, where you could transmit data, you know, reasonably fast, but nowhere near network speeds. So when manufacturers tried to get those things onto modern networks because everybody thought, oh, faster is better. Well, some of those, I heard rumors, and this is just from some engineers that worked in the field. They said, yeah, now the conversion to a network version other than the serial version was done so badly that if you ping it six times in a row, the PLC will tip over and die. So there's that conversion. And the old PLCs, like you might find on some old container ships or older freighters and so forth, are of that sort. Now, I started modernizing the RV Kila Moana, and one of the things we ran into very quickly was, gee, we've got some really old PLCs, and finding replacements were actually getting harder and harder. Well, during that process, I started working with this guy. This is actually a Lantronics Senso, which is a kind of a PLC, and it represents a shift in the way manufacturing control is happening. So back in the day, each piece of the production line had its own set of logic, and they would operate almost independently because the lack of communication speed. Well, now that networking speeds are much, much, much higher, and the timing between them is going up. You know, one of the things that I started working a lot with was a concept called IEEE 1588, or Precision Time Protocol. It allows you to lockstep your manufacturing process together so that you could deliver parts into the production line, the next step in the production line, just in time. And it's designed so that more of the processing, more of the decision is made in a central location on a fairly powerful computer, and the devices out in the field were less so, more of just on off or controlling different pieces, but more centrally controlled. So that's some of the big changes that are happening to the production world. But the attitudes haven't changed. They're still kind of the old days where, oh, it's an isolated network. I don't have to have anything. You know, I don't have to even have logins, you know, just control it because it needs to happen just in time. We don't want to have to worry about a part arriving halfway in and jamming up a really, really expensive production line. Well, lots of interesting things are happening. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually toss this to Lou, because Lou, in a previous life, used to work with Anheuser-Busch. And he has some really interesting views of that production line.
That's right. I've been away long enough to probably give some of this information. I used to work as a system control engineer, so I used to manage their AAX and their network and all of their software, as well as a lot of the stuff that's on the lines. And so they have a ton of PLCs that manage their lines. And I can tell you that although the network was secure, the PLCs were not. I could easily log on to a PLC and acquire all the data, or shut it down, or make sure that it's operating correctly without using any secure information or secured logons. So if somebody were to penetrate the perimeter of their network, it would be just as easy for them to take over all of that. That includes all of their lines, all of their entire manufacturing plant. So it could be a big thing. Now, that was... I'm talking about almost 20 years ago. We used to work there almost 20 years ago. So obviously lots of things can change since then. But I definitely can tell you a lot of organizations, you know, that are a manufacturing business, you know, that I've worked with even now, still have yet to update their systems in this aspect. In fact, I have some friends in the industry that are mechanical engineers that do a lot of manufacturing line design, with new machines and new tooling. And they also have electronic systems and controllers that, again, still are not secured, even though the network is secure. So I think I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot more work to be done here to ensure that things will be more secure, and to not risk the things where, like, for instance, ransomware and even just taking over these lines and causing at least some disruption, which could hit the bottom line for any organization in the future. So I think there's a lot more work to be done here, and I'm hoping that some organization comes out and standardizes something.
And, you know, it's worth mentioning at this point that manufacturing is one of the industry segments that is included in the government's definition of critical infrastructure. So there are all kinds of new requirements and new considerations for these companies based on the most recent federal guidelines. Before we go, Oliver, wanted to ask you end up dealing with a lot of software and products for these small to mid-sized businesses. And while we often talk about this kind of thing in terms of the giant companies, well, like Anheuser-Busch, the majority of manufacturing happens in smaller companies. Have you seen any interest from the industry in putting out products that can help secure and manage these products that might be out there controlling smaller manufacturing businesses?
Not to be a troll, but no. at Industry 4.0, I mean, again, a marketing term. It's a bunch of technology that have been here forever, and a few technologies that haven't gotten here yet. So it's really just a collection of stuff we already got. And as far as smaller companies go, I guess maybe the reason we haven't seen it is they're cost driven, right? Anything on those manufacturing floors are very expensive to run, especially for a small to medium sized business. So the last thing that they're going to do is spend money on a maybe, right? Right now, all they view any kind of security issue as a maybe. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, and they don't spend money on maybes. They only spend money on stuff that's already happened, sadly. So since we're about to get into probably another couple of really nasty cyber wars, you can expect to see it happen, at which point, yeah, then you'll get their attention. Whether or not vendors are going to come out with solutions, I don't know. But if people like you three on the call want to help, one thing I think that'd be great would be I don't know, a checklist of things that they could do, you know, that the standard IT guy or a CISO could do, regardless of whether or not they're involved with the actual hardware on a factory floor. But like, what can you do now to make it a little tighter, aside from, God forbid, not, you know, doing away with an air gap network?
You know, you're absolutely right on the cost. I have been in and around small businesses. I have family members who have advised small businesses. And unfortunately, they're the same companies that can at least stand to bear the hits from a serious cyber hit. The sort of thing that might cost a large company $10,000 a day and be unnoticed in the round-off error for accounting. For a small company, they might have 2 or 3 days of that and be out of business. So it does matter. The hard part is just getting their attention. Well, this is the sort of thing we're going to end up talking about a lot more over time because it's going to be a continuing issue. As Oliver said, we've got more cyber wars that are likely to spill over into the manufacturing and civilian population. So we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about that. Right now, we have the opportunity to talk about other things. Before we do, though, Lou needs to talk to us about another great Twyatt sponsor.
Thank you, Curtis. That's right. Before we get to our host roundtable, we do have to thank another great sponsor this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thinks Canary. If there's anything we've learned from the last year is that companies must make it a priority to layer the security of their networks. We just talked about it. And one of those these layers needs to be Thinks Canary. Unfortunately, companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised even after they've already spent millions on IT security. Now, attackers are sneaky, right? Unknown to companies, they prowl networks looking for the valuable data. But the great thing about Canary is that they've turned this into an advantage for you. While attackers browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares, they will be looking for documents. They'll try to default passwords against network devices, web services, and they will scan for open services across the network. Thinks Canaries are designed to look like the things the hackers want to get to. Now, canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network, and you can make them look like and identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've actually been caught. And you can even put fake files on them and name them in ways that get hackers' attention, and you can roll them in Active Directory directly. Now, what attackers investigate further, they give themselves away, and you're instantly notified. Now, Canary tokens act as tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. Now, Canary is designed to be installed and configured in minutes, and you won't have to think about them again. And if an alert happens, Canary will notify you any way you want to, and you won't be inundated with false alarms. You can get alerts by email or text message on your console, through Slack, webhooks, through syslog, or even just their API. Now, data breaches happen typically through your staff, and when they do, companies often don't know that they've been compromised. In fact, it takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Now, Canary was created by people who have trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks, and with the knowledge, they've built Canary. Now, you'll find Canaries deployed all over the world and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Thinks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Thinks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we have a treat for you today. That's right. We have a host roundtable, but we're going to bring all the hosts back in, and we're going to talk a little bit about security. Now, with the past several years, as the remote workforce has scaled out, we've seen it, so many have needed to secure their network perimeter better than it was before. Now, the interesting thing here is the one thing that hasn't really caught on, even though it's proven to actually impact on the organization's ability to secure things, is actually multi-factor authentication. However, the key to multi-factor is that there's still risks. Now, you may have heard, in fact, Reddit hack from years past where they said that, in fact, SMS intercepts allowed attackers to actually skirt their 2FA protections. But the model was that was required for that kind of thing. It was a combination of both social engineering and SIM swapping and interception there. And it still was a lot harder than just using a password spray or a brute force attack to actually get into to their networks. Now, the interesting thing here is a lot of companies have a lot of data around MFA. In fact, Google actually has called out that their systems can block up to 100% of automated bots, 99% of bulk phishing attacks, and 66% of targeted attacks that occurred during their investigations just by adding a phone number and SMS-based MFA. So even though there is some risks to that model, it's still quite effective. In fact, the other companies like Microsoft has got data from their research that they called out that if you add MFA to your accounts, that makes them more than 99.9% less likely to be compromised if you're using it. So the data is there. The proof is there. The proof is in the pudding. However, there's some different strengths that we've talked about when it comes to factors. And the truth is some are more secure than others. In fact, you have things like authenticators, hardware keys like YubiKeys, which are actually fairly useful. RSA secure IDs. You have TPM chips in your devices that you have today that you're getting. And a lot more. And so what I definitely want to hear from the co-hosts here, because there's a lot of other applications for these, and I want to hear just how they've been using them. But before we do that, I do want to bring you guys back in and just ask a very general question here, because all of you work in the industry, you work with organizations. The question to you all is, why hasn't MFA been adopted yet? Like, what is the delay? Anybody?
I will tell you right now. I talked to the FIDO guy, the FIDO Alliance guy, Andrew Shikayar. I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly. He's one of their chief executives, and his comment was, all the major operating systems support it at this point. What 88% of all the browsers do. He said the only reason that he can think of that it isn't being adopted is A, of course, cost, and B, user headache. They don't want to know about it. It's another hurdle that they have to cross. It's a little less convenient than, you know, coming up with your own password. They're just used to what they're used to, and they don't want to change.
Good point, Brian. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just saying it. There's not a good standard, really. FIDO is as close as it's come so far. But if you want to run this type of thing on your iPhone versus your Android phone versus a tablet versus a desktop. If you want to use something like a YubiKey, there isn't one that works on all of them. The closest would be the Bluetooth jobs, but then you're sending something out over wireless. There's not a standard yet. And I keep hoping for something. The University of Hawaii uses Duo, and I happen to like it. They were a guest on the show quite a while back, and that's a pretty nice system, and I'm able to use it for all kinds of things, you know, AutoCAD, Fusion 360. I can use it for my Twit account and things like that. I've been a big, big supporter of MFA as much as I possibly can. But yeah, I agree with Oliver. It's kind of a pain. You know, I've gone to log in the middle of the night and go, darn, where's my phone? And I'm sure a lot of people saying, you know, I really hate that stupid dongle. Not the least of which, women have it a little easier because they can toss their dongle in their purse. But men stick it in their pocket. And if it's on their key ring, that means that dongle and the USB connector is getting mashed around against your keys. So there's a lot of people that say, yeah, that's fine, but what happens if the dongle breaks, or what happens if, you know, I lose it? There's a lot of things that people aren't sure about yet. And if you're not comfortable and it's not more convenient, they don't want to do it. Now, I will say there actually is a way to set up MFA for passwordless setup if you want. But that kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies, because, again, that means if someone lost it, that's it.
Right.
the military had a thing called common identity, common authentication card called a CAC card. They use it as IDs. And originally, you would actually bring your CAC card. You'd stick it into a reader at the gate as you drive up, and it will actually do a lookup against the military personnel databases and show you what picture that person should have, you know, what they should look like, so that, you know, cutting out the picture and putting your own picture there, that trick doesn't work. And it also is supposed to bring up some relatively simple biometrics so that you could actually stick your thumb or finger onto the portable reader. And that was a big, big, big push pre-2000 within the Department of Defense. And I got embroiled in that. But it's still not as easy. And I think, I agree with all of it. That is going to be the issue. It has to be easier than a password to get any traction.
Agreed. I think interesting. I was at Microsoft Build this past week, and I was watching one of the MVPs who doesn't work for Microsoft, but they had an authenticator, and they were logging into their sites. And, obviously there was a lot of conditional access that was going on there. But when they accessed it, just like you said, Brian, they would choose an identity that they had already previously logged in. And then that, of course, it would then send a ping to their authenticator. And of course, they had to enter whatever code they saw on the screen, and it would tell them where they were at. And then it would go and it would let them in. And it just seemed very fluid to me. Like it would just seemed very easy for them to do it. It almost seemed like, obviously it requires you to have a device. In this case, it was their phone. And the phone itself was secured. It was secured by biometrics. And then, the authenticator also secured by biometrics. It seemed so much easier than using a password, and they weren't even afraid of me standing over top of them because they didn't have to enter anything in there. And so that goes to the passwordless world that you talked about. So it just seems like organizations really, really should be thinking about this more, even though it could cost a little bit of money. In this case, the money could be just implementing the software. Now, a lot of these organizations, they already use customer identity and access management software. They already use Okta or Azure Active Directory or Ping or IBM or whatever beyond trust. And even if they're on premise, they can still implement these services that allow them to do MFA. They're usually tack on, but in the same sense, it still allows them to do it. And they can use services that don't require special hardware, especially if they use their devices that are already enrolled in Intune or MDM or whatever, so they're already secured devices. But it's very interesting to me to see the organizations being a slow adoption here. Now, I do want to get Curtis's thoughts here.
Well, I think that Oliver was entirely right in the idea of it's not what they know. In all of business, teaching people new things is expensive. I mean, Lou, think about your own experience. Anytime you change the location of one thing on a menu in an application, there are companies that scream because they're going to have to retrain their users, people who learn the app by the position of things and not what it actually says. So that's an important thing. The other one is cost. I mean, two-factor authentication from a business standpoint does have some cost associated with it, either because of the technology that has to be purchased to enable it, or because, once again, you have to train people to use it. So I think those two things, the non-familiarity and the cost, are what has made two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication a harder sell to business than reasonably it should have been.
Right. Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is, a lot of these devices cost money to implement. Like, for instance, Chiba, you talked a little bit about, using YubiKeys and other dongles. Why are these not being adopted?
Cost. Even if you buy large quantities, it's still going to be like $4 or $5 a dongle. And if you lose it, you know, who pays for it? Now, I do want to go and propose a middle ground. You know, the world doesn't seem to want to do one big jump. They always want to do baby steps before they start going. And what I've been recommending is the MFA PAM module for Linux especially, and, you know, just about any modern server operating system supports things like YubiKeys. And the cool thing is, most of the time you can go and set it up so that only the admin accounts have to have the dongle. You can let your regular users go and have passwords, force them to have complexity and change them every once in a while. But the ones where you can lose the most, an admin account, force those folks who tend to be more sophisticated anyway on as far as using this stuff, buy a dozen YubiKeys for your admins and backup admins and operators and people like that. People that can do a lot of damage if their credentials are lost, and start that way. And, you know, the software, for the most part, especially if you're running Linux or so forth, it's free. And there's some really, really good how-tos. In fact, I'm kind of hoping, even though we're not going to be able to go through all the URLs that we had for the research for this story, I'm kind of hoping we toss them all into the show notes once the show's done.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we have a lot more to talk about here. MFA is an important topic. But before we get to the rest of that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Nareva. Hybrid work is here to stay. That means people are going to go back to work, and meetings will have remote and on-site workers. And complicated and costly, that has been the state of audio conferencing for larger spaces for a long time. Now, choosing a traditional system might require difficult design software and selecting from a dizzying array of separate mics, speakers, DSPs, and more. And in those cases, installation usually requires outside technicians, somebody to come and help. And it's often invasive, highly invasive, and expensive. Plus, it could take your room offline for days, and it's very disruptive. Now, the industry was definitely primed for the same type of leap in technology that has transformed and simplified other sectors. Nareva made that leap when they created the revolutionary microphone MIST technology. And with this patented technology, one or two integrated microphones and speaker bars fill a room with thousands of virtual microphones. There are no dead zones, and everyone can be heard everywhere in the room. Pretty cool. Now, meeting and class participants can simply talk, move naturally in the space, and they can still be heard by anybody who's on the call, those remote participants. So thanks to continuous auto calibration, your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. No outside technician required there. And Nareva also simplified the installation. It's a 30-minute do-it-yourself job. That means big savings on time and cost compared to those traditional systems. Now, they've simplified management too. Nareva console gives IT the power to monitor, manage, and adjust their systems from anywhere. No need for IT to go from room to room. So ask yourself, you want to go with the costly and complicated traditional system, or make the leap to simple and economical Nareva? Learn more at Nareva.com. That's Nureva.com. And we thank Nareva their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with the host. We've had a host roundtable here. We've talked about a little bit about MFA and just how useful it is. But I do want to bring everyone back in again because, you know, MFA itself, there's some drawbacks, right? Who's got some drawbacks for MFA?
I'm going to jump in. Clocks. If your clock is off, I don't know if you've noticed, especially if you run a large organization, if the clocks on your servers are off by more than, I think, 3 minutes, and you're trying to log in to Active Directory, it's going to barf all over you. Clock sync is all important, especially when you start getting into MFA. So one of the things, I think that's one of the big reasons why NTP.org exists, being able to have accurate Stratum 1, which is, you know, direct clock sync in case of like a GPS or something like that, you could actually build a Raspberry Pi based Stratum 1 time server for yourself for under $200, including a nice external antenna that you could just paste on the inside of a window. Clock sync is big, super important, and just say, oh, that's close enough, isn't going to be good enough.
User Ed, if there's some problems, that will be a problem. So the last one, the last company that I was with, you can guess, we did two-factor, but the IT department, they just came around and installed it. There was no education whatsoever. And then a few months in, what they did was they rolled something out that automatically logged everybody out of their mobile login. If you were logged into, you know, x.com on your phone, which you had to be to get email, calendar, whatever, this thing just suddenly logged you out. When you tried to log back in on your phone, it demanded the key from the authenticator, which was also on the phone. And it wouldn't let you put it in until after you were halfway through the login process. So by the time you logged out and got it, you'd have to start over again, and you were caught in this loop. There was no instruction on where to go. There was no instruction on how to fix this. They didn't test it. So all of a sudden, you had a massive explosion because somebody didn't run through all the various use. I mean, that isn't even a very complicated use case, but there was not a lot of preparation. It's just rolled out, and users are, like I said, they're not used to it. They don't know what it is. They don't know why it's there. If there's a problem with it, it'll bring you down. People were relying on their phone calendars, and those people were suddenly paralyzed. So being more careful with it, that's another problem.
Well, and I want to throw my two cents in. I think one of the drawbacks is friction. I talk a lot about the friction in transactions and the fact that you want to maximize the friction for threat actors and minimize the friction for your legitimate users. Well, two-factor authentication does throw some friction into the process of logging in. And depending on how you implement two-factor authentication, how often someone has to authenticate, and whether you use single sign-on for your organization, it can be a little bit of friction, or it can be quite a lot. And the more friction there is, the more people will resent it, and the more they feel that it's cutting into the productivity, and therefore the more they will do everything in their power to work around it.
Right. So there are some interesting other areas that come into account here as well. I actually threw a link, Burke, if you have a second to look in the Slack there, there are a lot of drawbacks when it comes to MFA. And that's because the attackers are getting more sophisticated here in how they're going and determining actually breaking through MFA capability. And in this particular article, it actually talks about the fact that some of these are actually phishable. They're actually able to be obtained using phishing attacks. And then they're also called what they call channel jackable, which means that a lot of the channels that these multi-factor or these factors use are sometimes vulnerable, whether they're, you know, SMS channels or they are, they're phone specific channels. And so, you know, the fact is that there is a higher level of factors that you could go are more secure. But either way, you're still going to be vulnerable to these types of attacks. Now, the question, though, is that you have to ask yourself is just having a password, which could be used by anybody, that could be used, you know, with brute force attacks or password spraying, is that better than spending a little bit of money to implement FFA, where you're creating a lot bigger of a challenge for an attacker to get into your network or into your assets? And I kind of think that there's a return on investment there. But either way, I think the key here is trying to convince the C-suite to spend the money. So that's what I want to throw, Curtis. I want to throw this to you because you talk a lot of organizations. What should the IT groups and the security groups be doing to convince their C-suite that it's time to move to MFA?
Well, if you want to convince the C-suite, you've got one thing to do, and that's put everything in the language of risk. The reason that putting it in the language of risk works is that risk translates directly to dollars, and dollars, above all, are what boards and executives understand. So if you can point out that adopting two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication will reduce your risk and reduce it by a certain amount, and therefore reduce your anticipated costs by a certain amount, that gets their attention. You can, in order to make that case, do things like point to the two examples I had in my blip today, General Motors and Zola. Both of these were credential stuffing attacks, and credential stuffing attacks do not work with multi-factor authentication. Multi-factor authentication is like a decent firewall. Will it solve all of your problems? No. Will it weed out a lot of the problems? Yes, which means that your staff can focus on the truly significant issues. So if you want to convince the board, put it in terms of risk, translate into dollars, and that's the place where you have your discussion.
Well, now, let's talk about small business. I want to throw this to you, Oliver. You talk a lot of small business, SMB. Like, obviously, their budgets are smaller, but their risk could be bigger. What's something that maybe they can do to convince those powers that be that they need to spend the dollars?
I'm not sure SMB really has that big of a cost. I mean, this is one time I'm going to say it. MFA for most small businesses isn't that big of a cost to them on a per user basis, because their user count is just that much smaller. Their problem, like I said, is mainly education, and that can cost money, right? If you want to retrain it. So what they could do, and I was talking to a customer who shall remain nameless. What they did was they put together a V team, right? Some guys from IT, one outside guy, and a guy from marketing, and they literally redid their training with the guy from marketing translating what the technologists were saying into English, because the only thing that the IT department had done up to that point was pop up a knowledge base article that explained the whole MFA process, but they did it in using tech language that made most users' noses bleed after the first couple of paragraphs. And I don't know about you, Lou, what it's like now, but like I went to Microsoft in, 2008? And the first security training I got there said, don't use weak passwords, don't let anybody in the door, and here's how to spot a phishing email. And in 2021, I took the last security training from the last company that I was with, which isn't a small company. And what it said was, don't use weak passwords, don't let people in the door, and here's how to spot a phishing email. Maybe update that to include not just that we have MFA, but here's why. And here is a nice process of, what to do, how to get it installed on your own since you're all working from home, what to do if something goes wrong, like the three most popular ways that it could go wrong, like that little problem that I just explained, which has happened twice, steps where you can take, and maybe a help desk process that'll make this a little bit easier for users to understand. Another guy that I talked to, he did something for which you have to get exec support, but his CEO was an ex-IT guy, so he allowed it. He had the IT department hack people. Like, literally, if they had a weak password or if they didn't like what they were doing security-wise, they would fake hack them and leave up like a picture saying that your bank account had been stolen, something like that, something to get their heart in their mouth. And then they would explain to them why that happened and here's how to not have that happen. I thought that was a little extreme. And obviously if you do it without exec backing, you're probably going to get fired. But it is one way to get users to understand why people want to pay attention to this.
Right.
Actually, DEF CON, at DEF CON, they run the wall of sheep. And if you're using weak passwords or unencrypted logins, your name actually gets posted up on this big giant monitor called the wall of sheep. And it gets really interesting. But before I give it back to Lou, I just wanted to throw out one thing. One idea is users in general absolutely hate passwords. It's pretty common. And while going passwordless with a dongle gives me the heebie-jeebies, Kensington has a dongle that also requires you use a fingerprint. I think that's kind of a cool possibility, because then I have a carrot to dangle in front of users. You can have something strong. You can have multi-factor authentication, but you don't have to have a password because we want your finger. That's
expensive.
Dirty.
$50.
It's expensive. But, you know, we need a carrot for the users to move, and yeah. I don't know what kind of carrots we're going to have. Maybe YubiKey will do one that reads fingerprints. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to what Oliver was saying, I think, you know, without giving Microsoft's security posture up here, I can tell you that, like, all users are in, they're forced to follow policy. The policies are pushed down on us, and we're forced to follow them, which adds factors and adds other things into the mix, no matter what device we use to access data, software, source code. So I can tell you that happens from the ground up. We're also required to take plenty of training when it comes to all of this stuff. And it's required training. It's not like, you know, you can just kind of skip it. It's required that you go and do it. And then in the same sense, they also make you aware of exactly, you know, what the risk is if you don't use it. So I think they are doing their job. And again, I work with a lot of organizations, banks and financial institutions and other places that also are doing the same thing. So I definitely agree that education is one of the biggest factors here that will definitely help move things forward a little bit more. But Brian, really quick, I wanted to throw back to you because, you know, obviously dongles are one thing. You know, these new services are another thing. But is there anything that's going to be coming out or is out that organizations should look to that will help ease the pain here, that will maybe guarantee them some level of security that they would be like, okay, I just got to get that because that's going to be really helpful?
I actually use Duel, and one of the really cool features is when it prompts me to do the authentication, I have multiple things I can throw code in or whatever, but it will also push, and it will only push to the registered device. And as long as Duo is running on my iPhone, it just pops up. Is this you? Yes or no? And if I say yes, it logs me in. It's not quite as simple as swiping my fingerprint, but it's much more convenient. And I like it. You know, this is something it works fast, it works easy, and I have no clue how much it costs because UH just bought scads and scads of licenses for all the student, staff, and faculty. So someone bit the bullet and bought a lot of licenses, but, you know, that's probably what it's going to take.
Indeed, indeed. Curtis, I want to throw back to you.
Well, the one thing that I do want to bring up, and this for some businesses could be considered a drawback, and it's a reason to stick with multi-factor and not single factor that's biometric. In the case of a search of your device, the police, a government official, cannot force you to tell them your username and password. That's a Fifth Amendment issue. They can, however, take your fingerprint. They can hold it up to your face and use facial recognition. They can do an iris scan. Those things they can do. Passwords and usernames they can't. So the idea that we'll just replace all of our passwords with biometrics does have some flaws. Make sure that when you're going to multi-factor authentication, you're truly multi-factor, and you might want to involve your legal counsel in deciding just what those factors are going to be.
Great point to end on. Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, time flies when you're having fun. We definitely have run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twiet. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you and all of your work?
I have now moved the review project onto email marketing. Let me tell you, those apps are fun. He lied blithely. However, I also got to do some VoIP stuff, which I hate, but it's at least a little more technically interesting than email marketing. Again, you can catch everything that I write over at PCMag.com. That's sadly my whole, except for the Traeger. That's my whole life.
Fantastic. Thank you, Oliver, for being here. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. Curtis, you are a busy guy. You have a lot of stuff coming up. Where can people find you in the coming weeks? Where can people find all of your work?
Well, if you want to find my work, you can be a subscriber to Omnia. That's certainly an option. And you can also find me at darkreading.com on the Omnia page. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at KG4GWA. Also, feel free to come over and follow me on LinkedIn, where I do a weekly word on cybersecurity. And, you know, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm just all over the internet thing. Follow me. Send me a direct message. Would love to hear from members of the Twiat Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. We also have to thank our very own Mr. Brian Chibert. What's going on for the coming weeks? Where can people find you, and how could they get a hold of you, maybe to give you some show ideas?
Well, hey, I throw a lot of stuff onto Twitter, and I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. But, you know, if you want to just hit me directly, you're welcome to throw me an email. That's Chibert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T, at twit.tv. Or if you send it to Twiat at twit.tv, it'll hit all the hosts. And I think this week I need to go and find my cache of YubiKeys and start refreshing my memory on how those things are set up and so forth. I want to see if I can get it working on Chrome OS. That'll be fun.
Very nice, very nice. Well, thank you guys for being here. We also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and to listen and to keep up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, host information, guest information, of course, the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Definitely support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. And the best way to support the show is to definitely subscribe. Plus, you may have also heard, we also have Club Twit as well. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. And the great thing about it is it comes with a lot of great things. One thing is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord server. Lots of awesome channels on there. You can chat with the hosts, the producers, separate discussion channels. Plus, they also have a ton of special events on there. So lots of fun discussions. So definitely check that out. And, of course, they also have the Twit Plus feed as well. Now, join Club Twit and be part of that movement just by going to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, Club Twit now offers corporate group plans as well. That's right. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And it's really just a great way for your IT department, your developers, your salespeople, your tech teams to stay up to date with access to all of our podcasts. And just like regular memberships, that's right, they can join the Twit Discord server, be part of that fun, as well as get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So join it, twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because we talk about a lot of fun stuff on this show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely share it with them and get them to subscribe. Now, if you've already subscribed, we do this show live on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. That's all where all the streams are at. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see behind the scenes, all the banter that we do during the show. Lots of fun stuff. But if you're going to watch the show live, you got to jump into the famous IRC channel as well. That's at irc.twit.tv. They bring you to the Twit Live channel. It's got a ton of great characters in there. We have them there every week. We love it. We got Chumley, the Quishes, Eric Dunkman, Reverb Mike. All of them are chicken headed in there. A lot of people a lot of great characters, a lot of great conversations. Thank you for everybody for being there. So Jack, definitely join that as well, irc.twit.tv. Definitely hit me up. I want to hear all of your show ideas. I want to have lots of great conversations. I love social networking. So definitely hit me up at twitter.com/LouMM. I post my enterprise tidbits there. Also, direct message me. Give me some show ideas. Give me some topics. Tell us how we're doing. We definitely want to hear from you. Plus, you know, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week, you could always check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. Check out Office Script. It's our newest thing that we're putting out there. That's right. It's a way for you to actually generate macros off of your Excel online documents and run them, and maybe even change them using TypeScript, JavaScript, and modify them and actually run them periodically using Power Automate. Lots of cool stuff. So definitely check that out at developers.microsoft.com/office. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you, Leo and Lisa, for all your support over the years. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the show bookings and, of course, all the plannings for the show. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. We couldn't do the show without you. And before we sign out, I have to thank our editor as well, Mr. Anthony, and of course, our TD for today, Mr. Burke. Burke, how's it going, my friend? You keeping busy over there at Twit? What's been going on this week?
Yes, and I was almost caught by surprise again by this little segment. Today and yesterday, we were trying to review the new Apple repair tools for self-repair, and we got the tools, but the parts came in a week later. And
Now, the tools are like these huge, like, Pelican tools. Cases, right?
Yeah. Professional tools. And they were and the parts are supposed to arrive with the tools. The parts arrived literally this morning, about 45 minutes before we needed to return the tools, so we didn't lose our $1,000 deposit.
Oh, my God. Because otherwise they charge you like thousands of dollars, right?
Exactly. Micah Sargent.
Seems like a racket to me.
handled it like a champ.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see what happens there. Definitely looking forward to seeing what's in all of that and what it entails. Thank you, Burke. Great seeing you, my friend. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Don't miss All About Android every week. We talk about the latest news, hardware, apps, and now all the developer-y goodness happening in the Android ecosystem. I'm Jason Howell, also joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and our newest co-host on the panel, Wen Tu Dao, who brings her developer chops. Really great stuff. We also invite people from all over the Android ecosystem to talk about this mobile platform we love so much. Join us every Tuesday, All About Android on twit.tv.